Culture and Leadership Connections and Daily Greatness Planner have joined forces. I have been using the Daily Greatness Planner for 3 years now and can't imagine a week without it. A paper planner has a physically solid reassurance about it that I really need in this digital age of endless Zoom meetings and physical distancing. There are planner versions for every type of person, job, business, and lifestyle. They all help you achieve your goals and keep you accountable. Daily Greatness Planners feature a soft cover, stay open binding, paper that is such a pleasure to write on, you can just hear it calling to you, multiple check-in tools, note pages, inspirational fill-in-the-blank questions, affirmations, and more. I love that it is offered in several countries, so you don't have to pay ridiculous shipping and duty fees. Even better, if you subscribe to the Daily Greatness Tips when ordering your planner, you get 10% off your first order. To choose your planner and access your discount, go to shiftworkplace.com and click on Toolkits. Daily Greatness Planner will pop up right away. That is shiftworkplace.com, click on Toolkits, and you'll see Daily Greatness Planner and all the great options right in front of you. Enjoy. Hello, Culture and Leadership Podcast listeners. Today, I would like to welcome you to an interview with the British-Canadian singer-songwriter Martin Kerr, who has been building his career from the streets, one passerby at a time, and now has a following of thousands. In 2017, he went from busking to selling out the Windspear Centre in Edmonton, then opening for a well-known singer, Sarah McLachlan, at a 20,000-seat stadium, landing his album in the Canadian top 10, and then moving around the world to do concerts in 35 countries on his musical travels. Since that breakout success, Martin has been creating a fresh sound with producer Ryan Stewart, and the result is a new album, which is called Everything is Under Control, which has all of his intimate singer-songwriter approach with Stewart's contemporary pop sensibilities. It is really lovely to have you on the show, and I'm really excited to have you talk about musical leadership and moral leadership and spiritual leadership. So thank you so much for being on our show today, Martin.
My pleasure. That all sounds very important. I'm not sure if I'm up to the task, but I will do my best.
You just have to be your regular wonderful self and it will all come through.
Thanks for your vote of confidence.
So that was the official bio with a few fan comments from me. And I'm just wondering if you can tell the audience a little bit about who you are and what you do.
Yeah, I've always loved to sing and I never wanted to have a real job. So I dropped out of university shortly before getting a degree and moved to Canada to marry my sweetheart that I'd met on my travels and became a street performer, singing my favorite songs, including some that I'd written myself, and was able to build a career day by day, step by step that way. And now for the last 10 years, I've been doing music full time and playing on average two or three shows a week, over 100 a year, every year. And I honestly play every opportunity I get, whether it's in somebody's garage or at a big concert hall or festival. And that attitude of taking the music to the people has kind of served me well rather than waiting for people to come to me. I recognize in my travels and getting to know people around the world that everybody loves music, especially songs and stories. And by being able to bring those to people where they are, I've been able to connect with a lot of people heart to heart. So it's been a bit of an unconventional journey and career, but it's one that I really love.
And one that you do so well, you just always feel like you're the only person in the audience that you're singing directly to each person that's there, but every person that's there feels like you're singing just for them. I think that that heart-to-heart connection is something that comes across really beautifully. And I was wondering if you could share a couple of incidents from your childhood that you think made you into the person you are today.
Sure. You know, I'd always loved music ever since I can remember. I was singing. My mum would sing to me all the time, and my dad. Neither of them are musicians, but they love music and they gave me a love of music. My first experience as a performer really was at 5 years old, my first year of full-time school, the school Christmas play. I was given the lead role of Snow Robin, and I had maybe six solos during this little Christmas play, and was basically the star of the show. And but my teacher, who also happened to be the school music teacher, took me under her wing and she loved my voice and taught me to perform these songs. And my parents had no idea that I was going to be in such a prominent role as they came along to the school play. And as I hadn't told them and I didn't realize that it was a big deal, I was just doing what I was told. So I was basically the star of the show at 5 years old. And I could feel as we were performing the show, how these songs and my voice were affecting the audience emotionally. I could see people with tears in their eyes as I was singing. And my parents afterwards were so visibly moved by the experience and so proud of me that I'd managed to touch the hearts of all the people in that room, that it really gave me such a taste, not only for the music itself, but for the experience of bringing it to people and putting something inspiring and beautiful into people's hearts. After that, I just wanted that feeling again and again.
Wow. You know, as a parent, I had a similar experience with my oldest daughter, who is also a professional singer and songwriter. And she was 6, and she was put into a prominent role into a musical, and her music teacher, same thing, really took her under her wing and nurtured her and didn't give me any inkling that she was going to be the star of the show and singing all these songs. And every time she started to sing, there was a hush over the school gym audience, and people had tears in their eyes, and they'd look around, who are her parents, and I was like, wow, like this, I was completely taken off guard.
Yeah.
So I can just imagine how your parents must have felt when they had that experience.
Yeah, it was a really memorable time for me. And another one was when I was 13, I had written my first song about a girl I'd fallen in love with that lived far away. It was called 60 Miles Too Far Northeast. And I played it at the school talent show. And, you know, kids at that age can be very cynical and cruel to each other. But so I felt a bit nervous pouring my heart out on the stage. But I had the same feeling. It was my first performance of an original song that people were really taken aback and touched by something beautiful in that song, something very sincere. And I got some amazing compliments from people who had only ever called me names before. So I learned that to be brave and to try something new was really valuable, but also not to care about the results, because I finished 3rd in that school talent show. I was the only person who had presented an entirely original work, but I finished 3rd behind a bunch of teachers who dressed up and danced as the Spice Girls. And and a young lady who played My Heart Will Go On the recorder. So it was a real triumph for the arts. And so that also taught me that sometimes, you know, music's not a competition, and the results in terms of rankings and awards don't matter. What matters is how you touch people's hearts.
That's a great story. So you were born into, you were born into England, into a group in England, or from Scotland first and then to England, right? And so you have regional and national affiliations, and you were born into a religion. You lived in a small town and grew up there. Of those groups that you were born into, what would you say has most influenced your sense of culture and your sense of self and how you influence people?
I think my strongest identity for sure comes from my upbringing as a Baha'i. To have a sense of myself as a world citizen is really my foundational identity and how I see myself. I see the world as my home. And I realize that's quite a privileged position. Growing up with a British passport, being able to travel wherever I had the opportunity to go was a wonderful thing for me. But also with an attitude of possibility and idealism. Idealism is sometimes used as a criticism and a pejorative, but to me, it's a wonderful thing to see the best in people, to see the possibilities for the world, and for what you can contribute to it. So there's that kind of perspective of being part of a world civilization that is emerging and recreating itself. And also one of the greatest lessons I've learned from my Baha'i upbringing is that to be of service to other people is the highest rank or achievement you can ever have. So if I find myself doing humble things like playing on the street for people or singing at an old folks' home or at an elementary school or in for a very small audience in someone's backyard, even those steps along the journey, to me, those were not discouraging things. Those were opportunities to be of service to somebody. And so to have that attitude that there's no higher achievement than being of service to somebody, I think taking that attitude into my work as a musician has helped me not give up and have the right attitude. I think people feel that sincerity of motive. I'm not in it to be rich and famous or to bring other people down or to see other musicians as rivals, but really to try and make a positive impact on other people.
You mentioned to me earlier that your parents had this planet and then world map up on the wall, and that every night before you went to bed, your dad would quiz you on first the continents, then the countries and the capital cities. And, and so you really saw from the time you were really young that you were part of the whole world. Very few people get that kind of really conscious global education from their parents.
Yeah, and I feel so fortunate and lucky to have had that experience growing up. And my parents really got it from the Baha'i faith. Their parents, they didn't grow up in wealthy circumstances and from a working class background. But I think my dad spent a few years in Singapore as a toddler. His dad was in the Merchant Navy. And so he had this experience of another world in the Far East. So he'd always had this taste that there was more out there than just his hometown. So that was carried forward. And he gave me the same gift by putting that map on my wall and letting me know that the whole world was out there for me to explore and to meet, and that the peoples and the cultures of the world were just treasures waiting to be discovered.
Yeah, that's really beautiful. I love the way you explain that. You also grew up in a small town. Mm-hmm. And what would you say from that experience that influenced you?
It was a wonderful balance, really, having that world perspective as a Baha'i and opportunities to travel with my dad when he took business trips. He worked for the Baha'i Publishing Trust as the manager. And so he would often go off to book fairs and lugging around boxes of books in the back of the car. And we would squeeze in and sleep in there too. Driving around Europe as a five-year-old was a really pivotal 2 weeks for me. We went to 12 countries in 2 weeks. And so I had those experiences, but I also had the experience of being born and raised in one small town. There's a town called Oakham in the East Midlands of England, kind of a sleepy old market town. And so I was raised with the same group of kids at school and at soccer practice and in the plays that I was in. And so I had really long-term friendships and not the hustle and the bustle and the stresses of living in a city, but also had an outside perspective through my connection to the Baha'i community around the world. So looking back, it was a wonderful place to grow up. We spent a lot of time outside playing sports and riding bikes and building forts and that kind of thing. Having my kids growing up in Alberta now, where it's covered in snow half the year, we have lots to enjoy here, but I do see now the benefit of being able to go outside all year round.
No kidding.
And roll around in the grass and climb trees and stuff. So that was a great part of childhood for sure. Hmm. Being close to nature.
Right, right. That is something that a lot of children don't have the experience of, being close to nature, especially because most of the children of the world now live in cities with a lot of cement around them and steel.
Yeah.
And not many experiences with the natural world.
Yeah, absolutely. And it was an interesting place to grow up as well, because it was not a very diverse place at this little market town in middle England. There was maybe a couple of Chinese families in the town that both ran restaurants. And I knew of one black family in the whole town. So in many contexts, me with my red hair and strange religion, I was the diversity and was kind of used to being picked on for being different, which is not something that a white boy would often have the experience of, I suppose.
That probably made you into the sensitive musician that you are.
Maybe so, yeah. Yeah. And having an outlet of music and words. I think the other gift that being raised as a Baha'i gave me was a love of language, because the prayers and writings that we grow up learning and reciting is very rich vocabulary, almost Shakespearean and very poetic. So I grew up with a grasp of language that many other kids don't have. And so I was able to express myself from quite a young age about how I was really feeling and thinking and imagining. So that kind of led me towards poetry and songwriting as well.
Mm-hmm. So from the groups that you chose to belong to, because you chose to belong to the music industry, you chose to belong to the Canadian, Alberta, Edmontonian, Western Canadian culture.
Yep.
You married a woman from a different culture from you. So what aspects of those cultures would you say have you adopted into who you are and how you see yourself?
Interesting. I don't often think about how I see myself.
You have a very strong outward focus.
Yeah, I think so.
You probably do. Let me just come back to that, because you can't have an effect on an audience without being able to see yourself. Your effect on other people is part of the capacity to perform well.
Yes. Yeah, that's true. And music itself has a power, and often I let the music do the talking and throw in a few little stories and jokes here and there to keep us connected. But the question was about...
It was about, you know, basically when you go around, and you've also lived in different places around the world, has any... Let me give you an example. Mm-hmm. So, you know, there are an awful lot of Persian immigrants here where we are right now. And when I first met Persians, I felt that they were so indirect that I couldn't really grasp things. And I started to, over time, adopt things from Persian culture that I came to love. And one of them is when you come into a room, you shake everybody's hand and you show that each person individually that you're happy to see them. People just don't do that in most contexts. And when it's not happening somewhere, I feel that there's a significant loss that we should all adopt that. When I lived in Japan, I got very used to bowing. These are just small things, but I got very used to bowing and I found it so gracious and beautiful. And when I came back, it took me almost a month to stop myself from bowing all the time when I met people. You know, my first impulse was to bow rather than to shake hands or to greet them by looking at them. And it just, I just missed it very much. And so it's those things have, I think, shaped the way I see my interactions with people. That I'm certainly much more respectful and reverent and deferential than I was before. I used to just go in there like a bull in the china shop. Now I'm so careful that I don't, you know, I don't want to tread on anybody's feelings or heart in the wrong way. I would say those experiences have affected me in that way. Does that ring any kind of a bell for you?
Yeah, it really does. Those kinds of formalities that you're talking about, to acknowledge each person that you encounter, those are really beautiful things and very powerful. And that's maybe something that in a newer culture like we have out here in Western Canada, where most of the people have only been here for one, two, three, maybe four generations, or from all different places, we tend to have lost a lot of those formalities. So I think that can be a good and bad thing. And one of the things that I love about living in Canada is a sense of positivity and possibility, that when you try to do something new or bold, people tend to get behind it and say, yeah, go for it, or how can I help? Whereas I felt like growing up in small town England, that there was less of that attitude. And if you stuck your head above the parapet, you were going to get something thrown at you. There was much less tolerance for people being different or bold or trying to make something of themselves. Whereas out here, it seems like that's what's expected and what everybody wants for each other. I really enjoy that positivity of Canadian culture. It's an emerging culture that we're kind of figuring out as we go along. And that's one of the exciting things about it.
You know, living on the prairies, people often say that expanse of skies is really conducive to thinking of possibilities.
Yes, very much so. And I remember being quite gobsmacked and amazed by the expanse of sky driving down Highway 2 for the first time from Edmonton to Calgary. I had never seen anything like it in my life. So it does inspire wonder, and the sense of space makes you feel appropriately small and can make your worries and troubles seem appropriately small too, and give you a sense of time and possibility that you might not have in more crowded places.
And maybe we can take some of those worries and throw them up into the vast expanse of sky and forget it.
Yeah. You know, I think there's a really nice sense of acceptance here as well that I feel resonates with me and my own attitudes. That's one of the reasons I feel so at home in Alberta, is I feel like people here are from all over the world, and it's kind of a given that everybody is welcome. That's not true in every context, and I'm sure people from different backgrounds have different stories to tell. But I do feel that in general, it's a pretty healthy, diverse community that we have here. And I really love being able to walk through the town or get on a bus or go to a restaurant and meet people who literally have come from all over the world, first generation Canadians and visitors. To me, that's really exciting. And so I enjoy the learning opportunity that provides to meet somebody from a different background every day.
Yeah, I think what you say too about being accepting, it's often surprising to people from Eastern Canada. They think that they're so much more advanced than we are in the West, and that in the West we tend to be rednecked. But We had in our two major cities, Calgary and Edmonton, the first Jewish and the first Muslim mayors in Canada. And at the same time, there are so many instances of Alberta accepting diverse populations sooner. And Calgary, in fact, has the highest percentage of mixed race marriages in all of Canada and has been that way for the past 15 years.
That's amazing.
What you're experiencing is fact.
Yeah. And I think that taste for adventure and novelty and diversity in my life really manifests itself in that I'm always eager to meet new people, and I'm really good in the first few minutes or hours or days of a new relationship. I'm not so good at being a good friend to people long term, and I see that as a weakness in myself, that I'm so interested in what's new that I don't always take the time and the care to really nurture relationships in the long term, and give people the benefit of the doubt. The challenges that you encounter long into a relationship, whether that's as a friend or family member or working relationship, are quite different to how it feels in as you're just getting to know somebody.
That's certainly true.
So that's a side that I need to work on, I think.
Well, that's also a characteristic of what they call third culture kids, meaning children that grew up either because they had been displaced and they had to straddle different cultures, many Baha'i children because of their global experience, and also people who traveled a lot or lived in different countries, learned different languages. They feel that it's easy to connect with people who are not like them and not so easy to maintain long-term relationships in a particular geographical location and feel much more at home with novelty than they do with similarity.
Yes. I'm kind of allergic to scheduling. I instinctively flee from routine, even though I recognize that it's probably good for me. I kind of have this magnetic aversion to being tied down to doing the same thing each day. And that's one of the reasons I opted for such an unconventional career. But in actual fact, it requires an incredible amount of self-discipline that I don't always find in myself to make progress in running your own business and your own team. So I may have shot myself in the foot in that regard.
Maybe not. I'm sure you'll find your balance. But that actually brings me to my next question, which is people are born with a temperament which doesn't change.
Yeah.
And then over time, they acquire personality characteristics that are a result of their experiences and responses to the obstacles they face. So what would you say is your temperament? You just mentioned the thing about aversion to scheduling. Do you think that's part of your temperament?
I think being in the moment and experiencing things with all five senses and a connection to the spiritual. I'm not sure if it's born in me or if it's raised in me, probably a bit of both. It certainly hasn't been raised out of me as it is for many people. And so that informs my perspective and my attitude to life and perhaps my aversion to scheduling, that I don't want to miss something because I'm too busy following a schedule. There's always things happening in the world spontaneously, and I want to be open to those things that I may not have imagined or planned for. So being spontaneous and adventurous and are certainly characteristics that have stayed with me and grown. And I think the fact that I had a stable, positive, safe upbringing and never experienced any real trauma was a massive privilege, and also has given me an attitude that the world is generally a safe place. I know for many people that's not the case. So I feel very fortunate in that regard. But that's kind of my attitude to things, is that everything will work out and that I'm going to be all right. So that gives me a freedom to try things and to meet new people and to take risks. And I want to take advantage of that.
It also makes it easy for other people to interact with you because you're a safe person.
Maybe so.
Yeah. And you're not going to suddenly do something volatile or show great lack of integrity or anything like that, because you're solid in the way that you approach life, seeing that the world is a safe place and working in safe ways and being informed with spiritual principles that makes you a safe person to be with.
I hadn't thought of it that way.
What would you say, personality-wise, have you added on to what you might have been born with?
A little bit of irreverence, perhaps. I appreciate a lot of dark humor. Yeah, maybe my sense of humor is a little bit risque sometimes. So that's something that probably my parents didn't intend for me. But I think that there's a kind of a an undercurrent of questioning the way things are that I've inherited and kind of run with a little bit. So a slight attitude of rules are meant to be broken, or at least to be explored.
It sounds to me like you built on your temperament in a fairly solid way. Mm-hmm. So you expanded on what you had. Sometimes yeah. people make a pretty drastic change, and other times they just aren't really aware of what's what. But I would say you're pretty clear on, you know, how you move through the world and how you like to see things, and then you've just used that as a foundation to build on.
I like to challenge myself step by step and try something a little bigger each time, and sometimes a lot bigger. I've gone from playing on streets to playing in progressively bigger theaters, and on my own dime, taking the risk to put down a deposit and sell the tickets myself with a bit of help from my friends.
Which has turned out amazingly well, but not without a lot of blood, sweat, and tears.
Yeah, and I think that's something that I've been pleasantly surprised by. The idea of running a business seemed like a very scary thing, and I never saw myself as a businessman. I wanted to be an artist and an explorer and a singer and performer, not a business person, but I am a business person now, and it's not as scary as I thought. And what has surprised me is that, you know, I grew up assuming that the world of business was very cutthroat. And maybe it is in the higher echelons, but I find as a local business person working in fairly humble circumstances that for the most part, other people want me to succeed. And when I ask for help, people step up and offer it. I'm constantly and very pleasantly surprised by how much people want to help me when I ask for it. So that has been a real blessing and an encouragement to me. And so that's something I've learned, I think, is to ask for help. And that's maybe not a very manly thing. That's probably one of the things I'm most grateful for, is that I wasn't raised to be manly. I was allowed to have a feminine side and to cry and to sing and dress up and all the kinds of things that kids do, but some boys are told not to do. So I've not been afraid to ask for help, and people have really blown me away with how much they have offered in return.
I'd say you seem very strong and solid in your masculinity. And that's probably because you didn't have to feel that you had to fit yourself into some kind of a small mold that was mm-hmm. of what was expected of you, that you could actually explore things and find out who you were as a man. And yeah. I haven't often talked about this on the podcast with people, but I'd say a lot of men are very uncomfortable with themselves. And I don't feel that from you. I'd say you're pretty comfortable with yourself.
Yeah. I mean, I'm not always proud of every choice I've made in life, but I do feel comfortable as a human being, as a man, as a father. I don't feel like I have anything to prove. I feel like each day is an opportunity. And I really do feel lucky that I grew up with strong female role models and with the real sense that girls were as good as boys and were as valuable, if not more valuable, than men in many ways. Many of the most influential people in my life were women, teachers of music and drama and at school, and my mom and my sister. I have an older sister, so I was very dependent on them growing up. Yeah, and to me, it was never a question that women were in any way lesser than men. So yeah, I was never discouraged from expressing any so-called feminine traits. And I think that allows me to be very comfortable in my own skin, even though I'm not the most butch of guys. That's never been a problem for me.
But you do have an adoring female fandom.
Yeah.
It probably wouldn't even have happened if you wouldn't have just been comfortable with who you are. It's authenticity that's attractive.
Yeah, I agree. And that's what I'm attracted to in other people. And that's one of the wonderful things about getting to work in the arts, is that people are making their living out of being authentic and exploring what that means. So, you know, one of the things I didn't anticipate about being an artist is it's sometimes how lonely it can be. And it's a bit of a trade-off, because I'm very independent being a solo singer-songwriter. I don't really have to count on too many other people. But also I spend a lot of time working alone, which as a gregarious, outgoing person doesn't always suit me down to the ground. So that's another balance I have to strike in my latest project that I'm working on right now, is a collaborations project where I'm co-writing each song with a different artist. So that's been a really cool experience, opening myself up to new sounds and ideas and ways of working.
I love it. Mm-hmm. Looking forward to hearing what that's going to be.
Thanks.
Another question that I have is, because, you know, you've traveled a lot, but still you must have been aware that when you went from one place to another, that what was normal to you culturally wasn't normal to the other people, or what they were doing wasn't necessarily normal for you. Did you have any experiences that you could explain where you became aware that your cultural understanding was specific to you and not just the norm?
Yeah, I'm not sure in terms of my travel, but every time I log on to social media, I'm surprised by some of the attitudes and beliefs that people hold who I thought I knew, people who I thought were like me and thought like me, actually can sometimes hold seemingly opposite views, or see reality in a totally different way. And I think we saw that a lot in 2016 with a couple of big votes that happened that took people by surprise. So, yeah, I think even within our so-called cultural groups, we can often be taken by surprise. And growing up in a community like the Baha'i faith, where you meet other Baha'is and you expect them to have the same views and beliefs and practices that you do, it's not always the case. If we really want to get to know somebody, we have to ask questions and be open to hearing the answers. That can be a really great process. And to do it face-to-face, voice-to-voice, rather than just by text message or status updates, I think is the most valuable thing.
When sometimes it's very painful.
Yeah, it can be.
It can be good, but when you get past that honeymoon stage, you start to get on each other's nerves, and then you reach that point where you sort of, according to Scott Peck, you know, create community in these stages. The first one is honeymoon excitement to be together and enjoy the differences. And the second one is where you get at each other's throats. And the third one is where you finally detach and say, you know, let me just listen. Who are you? When you do that, you start to get insights, and you also start to realize that there are boundaries that you're not going to be able to cross.
Yeah.
Have you had any experiences like that?
Yeah. I mean, I work not so much interculturally in a way that you would think, but I work very closely with one individual who's my manager. He started off as my friend. We met playing soccer, and now we work together on a daily basis, and he helps me manage my music career, finds opportunities for me, negotiates contracts, comes up with ideas. And we actually come from quite different cultures, even though we grew up half an hour's drive from each other. He was raised in a very different way from me. And so some of our attitudes are quite different. And sometimes I just have to let that go. When we reach an impasse, we just need to step back and get back to what we're good at, which is working on projects together. So I find that sometimes not everything has to be talked about. Though it's good to listen to each other and get to know each other, sometimes we have to get back to working and serving together, and people can grow together closer through the experience of being productive and helping each other in practical ways. So yeah, sometimes when it gets too much, we just knuckle down and focus on actually building something together. So that's something that I've learned.
Actually, I really like the insight that you provided talking about that, because when you work closely with another human being, you're going to run into obstacles that you, mm-hmm. that you may never overcome. And it reminds me of an interview that I did a couple of years ago, where I was talking to someone who went to study in China to learn Mandarin, and he was at an intercultural event where the Chinese and the Canadians were being introduced to each other, and they were put through an intercultural values exercise. Mm-hmm. And they had to make decisions about what was a worse offense. So there were things like, here a scenario where you promise to a friend that you're going to do something for them, and then you just don't show up and don't do it and don't apologize. And then another one where you would set their house on fire. They seem to be very drastically different. So when you had the two different cultural groups vote on what they thought was most ethically reprehensible, the Chinese all voted for things like, you know, you say you're going to be there for a friend and you don't show up. And the Canadians all went for, you burn the person's house down. That would be much more reprehensible. When they discussed it, they were incredulous. How could the other group possibly choose that? That was just wrong-headed. What a mistake. Then the facilitator explained how those different cultural expressions of value came to be. And then they all nodded in approval, and they felt that they'd grown in understanding. And then he said to the group, so would anybody like to change their point of view on this now, about which they consider to be more reprehensible? Nobody changed anything.
Right.
And this person that I was interviewing said, which showed to me that even when you understand people, even when you have an intimate connection with them, it doesn't mean you can be them and they can be.
Right.
And I just, that really struck me.
Yeah.
As how intercultural understanding doesn't mean you become the other group and they don't become you. You know?
Yeah, and it's understanding, not agreement. We don't have to agree on everything to work together effectively.
Mm-hmm. Exactly.
I think we have to agree that being united and working together, not against each other, is the most important thing. Those other things can wait.
And we discover the commonalities when we work together on common projects.
Absolutely.
That's a frequently a really good way to build friendships.
Yeah.
So we're getting to the end of the interview, and I usually ask people that if they were, you know, being hired by somebody, in your case it might be someone hiring you for a concert to perform, but if you're being hired by somebody and you had to tell them, this is how you work most effectively with me, what would you say?
I would say, please be direct. Say what you mean the first time. Mm-hmm. Ask questions. And don't be afraid of offending me. Obviously, I like people to be polite, but also direct and frank. And I really appreciate that in people. I've got a pretty thick skin, haven't done what I do for many years. And I appreciate honest feedback.
That's great. Anything else you'd like to say?
Your last question brought up one other thing for me, which was when I was traveling around the world, and particularly living in China, people were very interested in me and the way I did things, because I was the visitor, the outlier. And people in China particularly have at least they did at this time, back in 2001, 2002, a great fascination with people and things from the West, because it was fairly soon after they had begun to have access to the rest of the world. And I constantly found that people were saying, oh, so Western people do it this way, or Western people think this. And I found myself constantly correcting them, saying, actually, no, I'm quite different from a lot of Western people in that attitude or that practice, particularly with my attitudes towards the world being one country and having a sense of global civilization and world unity, which to many Western people are terrifying concepts of some dark scheme. But to me, you know, possibilities for a more peaceful world that we can build together. And I realized that as a traveler, as someone who was willing to leave everything and everyone they know and move to the other side of the world, I'm already an outlier and don't really represent my culture. So people are looking for me to represent England or Canada or the West, when actually I'm quite different from most people, because most people would never move to China and start all over again. So that was an interesting thing to realize, that I'm by default representing my country, but also quite different from a lot of the norms that I've left behind.
Mm-hmm. We are individuals, and yet we belong, and we don't belong. And in not belonging, we still belong differently. It's a whole sort of mystical connection between the micro and the macro, and the individual and the collective. But it's interesting to think about, for sure. Is there anything you'd like to share with the audience or promote?
There was one more thought that came to my mind, which was a kind of catchphrase that I developed for myself when I lived in China, was that every place has beautiful spots, and every place has good people, and every person has good places. That's what it was. I was saying it in Chinese to myself, so
why don't you say it in Chinese so we can hear it?
每个地方有好人，每个人有好地方。 And I'm not sure if that's grammatically correct in Chinese, but it made sense to me that every place has good people and every person has good places. To look for the good in everyone and every place you go, there's always wonderful things to discover. So yeah, that's kind of been my attitude to exploring the world and to exploring new vistas in business and in art, to look for the positive. In terms of things to promote, I love it when people listen to my music and feel inspired by it and want to share it with other people. I have a fun song out at the moment called The Isolation Groove, which I hope will help people get through some of the lonely times that we might be experiencing right now. It's a bit fun and silly, and it has a fun little dance to learn as well on the YouTube video. So that's something you can share. And there's another one called You're Amazing, which is very shareable and tends to make people smile. So if you know someone who could use a lift, send them one of those videos and hopefully it'll make them smile.
Oh yeah, they're both great. I've shared them frequently with people.
Thank you.
Yeah, they're super. Thank you so much. I will put links to everything that you do in the show notes so that we can promote what you do and help more people discover you. Thank you so much, Martin, for joining me and for agreeing to do this interview. I feel honored.
It was great to chat with you, Marie. Thanks for the opportunity.
From a 5-year-old star in a Christmas play to a 13-year-old love ballad to an internationally renowned singer and songwriter, Martin Kerr has spent his entire life touching hearts and spirits with the power of his voice. His experience growing up with a world citizen consciousness in a small English village set him up to pay attention to both the micro and the macro, developing an ability to take tiny daily actions and turn them into universally applicable tearjerkers or stinging commentaries on social justice. Martin leads through voice and through emotion, but he is grounded in a powerful spiritual reality that shapes and forms his sense of self, culture, and leadership. That spiritual reality is the teachings of the Baha'i Faith, from which he derives foundational beliefs about the elimination of prejudice, the equality of women and men, and the independent search for truth. I very much enjoyed my interview with Martin Kerr, and I'm a big fan of his music, which you can find by Googling Martin Kerr and by checking out our show notes on the shiftworkplace.com website under podcasts. Thank you for listening, and may culture and leadership connections continue to inspire and guide your day. This podcast would not be possible without the expertise of our culture and leadership connections production team. A big thank you and shout out to Mike Kurlander for audio production and editing, to Malvika Kathpal for the show notes, Bernadette Guadiz for online web and social media management and promotions, Celine Bayogo for design, and Kirsten Hoyer for website and branding. Thank you so much. Hey, Culture and Leadership Connections podcast listeners. Do you love these insightful and moving interviews published twice monthly for your listening pleasure? You may not know that it costs between $300 and $500 per month to pay for our podcast episodes. Shocking, but true. Well, now you can help support this podcast by showing your love with a little skin in the game real money on the Patreon website. For as little as $5 or as much as $50 a month, you can contribute to keep Culture and Leadership Connections alive and healthy. Your donation is invaluable in helping us connect the hearts and minds of people across cultures and professions for happier and more humane workplaces. I know you will call on your inner generosity, knowing that your contribution is a practical demonstration of love and support. Check out the patreon.com/cultureandleadershipconnections page to see what subscription level feels right for you and find out about the special loyalty perks at each patron level. That's spelled P-A-T-R-E-O-N, patreon.com/cultureandleadershipconnections. Thank you for your generosity.